And both of you. Next, last case for argument, United States versus Dean, Mr. Truman.
May it please the court, Your Honor. Attorney Donald Chuning appearing on behalf of the appellant Lavelle Dean. I represented Mr. Dean in the district court in the Eastern District of Wisconsin in the trial in this matter, and the issues before the court today relate solely to the sentencing. This case is one that arose between this court's decision in United States versus Booker last July and the Supreme Court's decision in Booker this past January. And it arose during the period of uncertainty where we didn't exactly know what role the guidelines were going to play, and what role the federal statutes were going to play in lieu of the guidelines, what was going to fill the guideline vacuum. This is not a Palladino case. This is a case where Chief Judge Randa acknowledged that the guidelines were not mandatory, and he imposed what he deemed an indeterminate sentence. The Seventh Circuit decision, this court's decision, left open the consequences of the extension of the Sixth Amendment principles of Apprendi and Jones and Blakely to the guidelines, and it was unknown at that time whether the guidelines were severable. Judge Randa deemed the guidelines not severable. They couldn't be applied in a piecemeal fashion, and therefore rendered them advisory in the strictest sense of the term guidelines. And ultimately, he was vindicated in that extent by Justice Breyer's decision, the remedial decision, and the Booker decision.
Well, what is it you think he did wrong? I've lost the thread.
Well, what I think he did wrong is he got it right that the...
Yeah, not what he got right. What did he get wrong?
He got wrong that Section 3553A is supposed to fill the vacuum left by the guidelines. And one of my arguments is that the judge did not look to 3553A for guidance in the substantive rules that are to be applied in sentencing post-Booker. And the other thing he did wrong is that he didn't follow through with Rule 32 and the case law regarding application of the guidelines and follow the procedure that is to be applied to resolve disputed factual issues under the guidelines.
Yeah, and that's where I think that issue might be a significant issue, because he didn't conduct an evidentiary hearing. My question to you is, what evidence would Dean have proffered to contest the government's evidence?
Well,
And this is on that 2K2.1 enhancement.
Just on the 2K2.1 right. Enhancement, whether or not his possession of the firearm was in connection with another felony offense. And the government's evidence was essentially that there were drugs in the porch and in the home into which Mr. Dean fled, and ultimately where the gun was found. And there was also evidence that when Mr. Dean was apprehended, a cell phone was removed from him, and that the officer who arrested him received a telephone call from somebody who requested two. The officer interpreted that to mean two pieces of crack cocaine. The key piece of evidence, and the two arguments we would have raised, not arguments, but the two challenges we would have been presenting in the evidence is, one, that there was another individual on the porch and who had been present in the home all day, and that was David Carey. And that was the defense at trial, was that this was David Carey's operation, and David Carey was more likely the person who had the gun.
It was his house, is that right?
Well, it's unclear whose house it was. Actually, it wasn't David Carey's house. It was a woman who was in the house. The other argument would have been that, and ultimately would have been a kind of an on-the-spot call, whether we called Mr. Dean to testify to this fact, but the person who called asked for Lavelle, and Mr. Dean, through conversations with me, I know nobody knew him as Lavelle other than his mother. Nobody on the street certainly knew him as Lavelle, and Mr. Dean would have testified. Obviously, he's not a drug dealer. Nobody would have called him, asked for Lavelle. The street name was Chewy, I think, is what he said. And that would have ultimately been a credibility determination that Judge Randa would have had to make.
Well, he said he was using drugs in the house, right?
Isn't he did tell the police that he was using drugs. That was not a basis that was brought forth by either the PSI or the government as to provide the connection, the nexus between the gun and another felony offense.
Well, suppose we disagreed and thought the evidence was overwhelming, that it was his gun and cocaine. Now, what is your other complaint about what the judge did?
Well, the other argument is that when the judge is left with this vacuum. Well, the guidelines are out. What does he apply? And the judge used...
Well, it's not left with a vacuum, and the guidelines aren't out. He can follow the guidelines. He just he's just not bound by them.
Okay, I agree.
So
he
if
didn't.
He follows them, then what more does he have to do?
Well, I mean, there have been decisions since this case was submitted on the brief. So, like, Palladino was before this case that suggested that if it's a guideline sentence, that's enough. It's per se reasonable.
Do you disagree?
I do disagree with that.
Okay, so what is it you think the judge has? You think the judge has to go through 3553A?
No, I don't think he. I think he needs to be looking to 3553A for guidance.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? It means he has it in mind.
3553A has a whole bunch of provisions. Does he have to go down all of them and discuss them?
No, that would render sentencing to be a little more than a, you know, well, it would render sentencing to be a little more than a recitation of magic words in the statute, and I certainly
well,
don't.
I don't know what you're talking about. He doesn't have to examine each of the subsections?
The record has to indicate that he considered the appropriate factors.
Well, what does that mean? The first factor is the nature and circumstances of the offense and the history and characteristics of the defendant. So let's just look at characteristics of the defendant. What does he have to do to comply with 3553A1?
Well, I think he has
to... heading of characteristics of the defendant.
He has to make statements on the record that reflect that he has considered whatever characteristics of the defendant he deems relevant and influence his decision in the sentence. He did do that in this case. And that's part of my argument.
Does he list the characteristics?
He addressed some of Mr. Dean's character. I think he did. Because mm-hmm. Judge Randa, what he did, he didn't state this expressly. I'm applying Wisconsin
state
sentencing.
So now your suggestion is that after Booker, in every single sentencing case, in addition to computing a guideline sentence and saying and the judge has to go through... Has to have a 3553A statement?
No, I don't think it needs to be a statement. I think in the judge's pronouncement of sentence, in order to show an exercise of discretion, which I think is what lies behind a reasonable sentence and what the court should find lies behind a reasonable sentence, that he has set forth enough to let an appellate court or reviewing court, everybody know, that he has considered the appropriate substantive effects.
I don't understand. What does he have to do more than respond to arguments made by the defendant?
Well, he doesn't have to respond to every argument made by the defendant.
Does he have to, suppose the defendant doesn't mention 3553A, does the judge have an independent duty to go through it?
No, I don't think he has a duty to, like I said, to go through as a checklist, but I think he has a duty to apply those principles.
I don't understand you. Suppose the defendant doesn't say anything about his characteristics. Does the judge nevertheless have to discuss 3553A1? Does he have to list the characteristics of the defendant?
I think if the judge rendered a sentence and it was...
Answer me yes or no.
Yes, I think he has to discuss the characteristics of the defendant.
Well, I find that disturbing because this means, I mean, the judges have enough trouble already sentencing. But now you're saying, I mean, if you go through the whole thing, you probably have 10 items here, and you're saying that in every case, the judge is going to have to discuss those items. So, for example, 3553A2A, need for the sentence imposed to reflect the seriousness of the events, to promote respect for the law, and to provide just punishment. So does he have to say, I think the sentence I'm giving will promote respect for the law and provide just punishment for the offense?
No, I don't think he has to utter those magic words.
What does he have to say?
He has to render a decision that clearly shows that the sentence is not...
Well, how can he clearly show without talking about promoting respect for the law and providing just punishment?
Well,
what are the synonyms?
In any case where the judge is making a discretionary determination based upon general principles like this, I mean, it's not necessary that he utter those words in order to reflect that he has properly considered appropriate sentencing factors.
Well, if he doesn't talk about promoting respect for the law, how do we know that he's considered promoting respect for the law?
Well, if it's not apparent from the transcript, then I mean that would be
one... How would it be apparent from the transcript?
Well, I think from the gist of the judge's pronouncement of
sentence... What in the transcript of his sentencing hearing is going to show whether the judge thought that the sentence was necessary to promote respect for the law.
Judges say a lot of things in sentencings, and they oftentimes...
You want to say a lot more, because you think that they have to do a 3553A analysis, even if the defendant doesn't raise any of these points, even if the defendant doesn't say this sentence is not needed to promote respect for the law.
I don't think he needs to utter those words. My argument is, in this case, the judge did not look...
It doesn't matter what words he utters. Your belief is that the judge has an independent duty to assure that the factors listed in 3553A justify his sentence.
Correct.
He doesn't have to use the same words, but he has to cover the bases.
I think that's what Booker says.
Booker doesn't talk about this. And even if the defendant doesn't raise any of these issues.
I do think that Justice Breyer's remedial decision does address this. And
it doesn't say the judge has to make a speech touching the bases of 3553A, does it?
No, it doesn't say he has to make a speech. But it does say that 3553A is the controlling substantive law
but
for federal sentencing.
But we usually assume that if a defendant wants to argue against a sentence on the basis of something in the statute, he has to raise the point. And you're saying the judge has an independent duty to, even if the defendant doesn't say anything.
Correct. I believe that in imposing a sentence, the judge's sentencing decision should reflect adequate consideration of those standards. From my experience in state court, that's routine. The problem is you don't want to get into a situation where it's just uttering the words and listening through the statute, but rather that it reflects an exercise of discretion, a reasonable exercise of discretion, which is what sentencing is.
Saying that he doesn't have to hit every factor under 3553?
No, I don't think...
He has to. So what standard should we apply? That he hits some of the factors?
Well,
you know, I know you're saying in this case you don't think it was enough, but is there any, like, standard or rule you would like us to adapt or adopt?
In this case, I think the real problem is the judge clearly wasn't looking at 3553A. If you read his language, he's looking at Wisconsin State's sentencing law for guidance at that point.
But a lot of the things that he hits from the Wisconsin statute fall in the 53.
Sure. There's only a finite number of reasonable policies that can control its sentencing, and he did hit on a number of them. He also hit on retribution, which I don't find it anywhere in 3553A as a principle set forth as Congress is something that should be considered at sentencing.
So you don't have any rule you would like us to adopt or any suggestion. You're just saying it's not enough in this case.
I'm saying it's not enough in this case. And, you know, for me to define what a judge's reasonable exercise of sentencing discretion would be and to throw out a rule, I mean, that's going to be developed on a case-by-case basis in the post-Booker world. I don't think that I can sit here and tell the court this is what the rule should be for all sentences from here forth. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chuny. Mr. Santel?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Mr. Chuny. My name is James Santel. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney from the Eastern District of Wisconsin. I represent the plaintiff, United States of America, in this matter. It is the position of the United States that the sentence in this matter was reasonable both procedurally and substantively. And to follow up on the conversation that you had with Mr. Chuning, it's our perspective that Judge Randa got this right, although, to follow up on Judge Williams, your concern about Rule 32, he may have gotten perfect. And frankly, I'll tell you at the outset here, as we indicated in our brief, that it would be better to have a better record in front of you today.
I have this question. This case is a little unusual, at least it is to me, in that he's charged, of course, with possession of a firearm, and then that sentence is enhanced by the finding that he was using the firearm in connection with another felony that he's not charged with, in this case, drug dealing. Now, doesn't the judge have to make a finding that he was, in fact, engaged in drug dealing as a basis for the enhancement? I don't understand that Judge Randa made any specific findings here about things like that.
He didn't. I can't stand before you today and say there's someone in the record of that transcript that...
Seems to me you'd at least have to have that finding since he's not charged with the offense.
As I've indicated, he did not. He did not make the finding. It's not there. And frankly, I wish this record was a bit more complete on that issue.
We have a Rule 32 violation. I don't think we have a Booker problem. We have a Rule 32 problem.
I think you properly described the issue, Judge. I think it is a Rule 32 issue. And the question then is whether or not, going back to the decisions of this court post-Booker, whether the sentence was reasonable and whether the process to get there was a reasonable one as well. When you look at Rule 32, obviously the Rule 32I sub 2 talks about the prerogative of the judge to introduce evidence on objections. He didn't do that here.
Right.
Plainly, the government was prepared to call the officer. Presumably, Mr. Chuning would have called or presented some evidence as well.
He didn't do that, and as Judge Cuddy said, he didn't make a specific finding.
He did not.
And that's...
That's correct. That's correct. To jump to that particular issue, however, that Rule 32 also says that the court can accept the undisputed portion as a finding of fact, and goes on to say in subsection B that for any disputed portion, other controverted matter, the judge can rule on the dispute or determine that a ruling is unnecessary, either because he's not going to consider it or it's not going to have an impact in the sentencing. One of the other key things...
So it doesn't fall in... This didn't fall into those last two categories.
It does not specifically...
Because it certainly affected the sentence.
It did. On the other hand, Your Honor, one of the things that's important to note, and we did in our brief, and it's a part of the record here, is that there are some undisputed facts upon which this court and Judge Randa could have determined that the enhancement, the 2K 2.1 enhancement, was in fact appropriate. And they are found, on page 7 of the sentencing transcript. The defendant indicated that he conceded that the crack was found at the house, both on the porch and in the bedroom. There's no dispute about that. And second, the defendant admitted smoking crack at the house, Judge Cudahy, as you indicated previously.
Of course, it wasn't his house. So it wasn't his house.
But in Seventh Circuit law, it's under Patterson and some other cases, it's very clear that a gun in close proximity to this kind of activity, drugs, is construed as being possession.
Most of those cases involve a conviction for drug dealing.
They do.
I mean, that's the basis of the enhancement.
They do.
But here we don't have... He's not charged with that.
He's not separately charged with that, but I would argue, Your Honor, that Patterson and that line of cases would support invoking those undisputed facts in this particular case, and the language of Rule 32 doesn't simply save this, but fully justifies what the judge did in the end. To get back to the initial point, I think the focus that this court has to have today, post-Booker, post-Supreme Court Booker, is whether or not this sentence was reasonable. Let me suggest, as I did before, that this case was reasonably decided, and the sentence, is a reasonable one.
Well, is it possible for a sentence which fits the sentencing guidelines to violate 3553A?
I think that it is possible for in the post-Booker world, for there not to be a complete connect. I'm searching for a circumstance where that would be the case, Your Honor, and that's why I'm pausing somewhat on that. But I think that the analysis plainly has got to be under 3553A, and it's possible, if to give some more thought to that, that there might be one of those where the diagrams don't intersect, if you will. Here, I think it's very clear that Judge Randa did, in fact, do the analysis under 3553A. Did he invoke that particular statute? No. But did he talk about the kinds of things?
Does this mean the sentencing post-Booker is now, twice as burdensome as before? Because before you just had to compute a guideline sentence. Now you have to do a 3553A analysis?
I don't think so. I don't think so, Your Honor. I think in many ways, you are almost going back
to a time.
That's
the punishment for those district judges who thought the guidelines were unconstitutional.
Perhaps
now
so.
Now they have the guidelines plus.
Now we have guidelines plus. We've got 3553A. I think the answer to your question, Judge, is no. I think that in many ways, making the point too firmly, that we're back into a situation we were before 1987, before the sentencing guidelines. Judges under Rule 32 have always, on disputed issues of fact that go to whether or not the judge is going to impose a higher or lesser sentence, things in mitigation, aggravation, have always called witnesses, have always presented documents and given the government and defense counsel the opportunity to do that. Under 32, that will continue. Obviously, the record would be somewhat better here had that been done in this case. And then judges have always looked at 3553 or its predecessor.
But here we don't have a situation where he articulated what he was and was not relying on.
That's correct.
I mean, that's the, that, you know, which I think is the problem.
That is correct. He did not specifically articulate it there. He didn't say that I'm invoking those portions that I described before. At the same time, I don't believe it's a basis upon which this court needs to remand this case for resentencing, not only because of the harmless error analysis that I described
that's
before.
That's your point. It would be harmless error because
exactly.
There were undisputed facts.
Precisely.
That
precisely.
Would justify the decision.
Precisely. And beyond that, getting back again to the reasonableness notion, as we said in our brief and Chief Judge Randa indicated, he's looking to all those right kinds of things under Section 3553. He's not identifying them with great particularity. He's not going down the checklist, but he's talking about the sentencing guidelines, the statutory maximum. He talks about the fact that even the criminal history category is premised upon a private home burglary. He talks about the nature of the offense. He notes it's a status offense. There's a presumption of severity. He talks about the gravity of the offense itself. He describes the firearm, notes it's stolen, it's not registered, and that ties back into the guidelines as well. He says the defendant committed this offense while he was on parole. He describes the character of the defendant, dropped out of high school. He had some illegal and early drug use. He talks about his family. Three sisters were disappointed in him. He describes a beautiful mother. Those are the judge's words. Brothers who were supportive. He talks about an employment situation. He says that's a negative. He doesn't have any employment there. And there may be some gang affiliation, although unproved, also a negative. And in the end, he says the guidelines are not far off. They're fairly accurate as to the sentence here. It is difficult to follow up on, Judge Williams, on your question about identifying a particular rule that the courts have to apply. My humble suggestion here today is that in this circumstance, Judge Randa, whatever that rule might be, did in fact do precisely what this court and other courts have indicated he should do, which is invoke those 3553 standards. It seems to me that when in a post-Booker world, when the court is looking to reasonableness, the court will naturally look at the reasonableness of the sentence itself. Here it's the statutory maximum, 120 months. It's plainly the position of the government that that is a reasonable sentence. And second, in trying to inform that decision about whether or not it's reasonable, the court should look at the process. Here, that process plainly, as I just indicated, did involve the judges looking at the 3553 analysis and various touchstones and deciding in the end, admittedly invoking some other language that perhaps may have been taken from his experience as a state court judge, but nonetheless reflecting and paralleling many ways the 3553 language, the same kinds of things that he should, in fact, have been looking at. The sentence was reasonable in both its ultimate effect, 120 months, and it was also reasonable in terms of the process itself. Mm-hmm. As I said, to the extent that the court has any difficulty with either one of those issues, the harmless error issue under Rule 32.1, again, for the government's perspective, does not compel this matter to be returned to Chief Judge Randa for resentencing. If there are any further questions.
Thanks. Thanks a lot, Mr. Santel. Mr. Chuning?
Thank you, Your Honor.
He doesn't have any time, but we'll give you a minute to rebut.
I agree with a lot of what Mr. Santel has to say about what the process is likely going to be like with.
Incidentally, I don't agree with you when you said you couldn't find retribution as a factor in 3553A. What do you think just punishment for the offense means?
Well, we could get into the judge also.
Well, retributivists believe that the just punishment is the punishment that equals the gravity of the crime. That's the theory of retribution.
Sure.
So I don't want you to read retribution out of this.
Okay. Well, again, we could get in. Getting back to the first issue, I guess, which is, regardless of the judge's determination and whether or not his factors mesh with 3553, I think you still have the issue of whether or not an erroneous procedure or an erroneous
right.
guideline determination renders the resulting sentence
well,
unreasonable.
That's true. But
and I mean, we've got both facets here. Just one point with regard to Patterson, which is the gun case, and that the suggests proximity to drugs is close enough. In Patterson, there was a clear connection between both the gun and the defendant and the drugs and the defendant. And the defendant said, that was my, you know, he was convicted, and those are my drugs and those are my guns, but they're unconnected. Here, Mr. Dean is never saying, those are my drugs. There's no nexus, and that's what we seek to establish or seek to have the government establish, a nexus between the defendant and the drugs. Clearly, if the government was able to establish that, I don't think there'd be any question that the jury had already found he possessed the firearm, which obviously Dean disputed.
Can't the guideline sentence be the presumptively comply with 3553A?
Well, this court has said that numerous times. I disagree with that analysis. I think you can have a situation such as in this case where the guideline...
I know, but shouldn't the defendant have to point that out? That is, I'm worried about a situation which you want us to require district judges to have a 3553A speech in every sentence where they touch these bases, even though the defendant's lawyer has not made a point of it.
What?
I mean, why can't the judge say, look, your guideline sentence is 135 months. I think that's reasonable. But, you know, if you have a different view based on 3553A, I'll be happy to listen to that.
Well, that would be, I think, in that case, if the judge were to do that, you're opening it up to discussion, and
right.
I think by listening to discussion, you are considering those factors.
So that would be okay.
I think that would be okay.
Okay.
And if he ultimately decided, yes, after considering those factors, the guideline sentence stands, then I think that would be reasonable.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chuny. And you were appointed.
Yes, I was.
And we thank you for your vigorous efforts on behalf
thank
of the client. Okay. Well, that ends the day, and court will be in recess until 9:30 Monday morning, I guess.